We've done more to map Venus and to look at the atmosphere of Mars up until that point, and knew a lot about Mercury, et cetera. Maybe more than we knew about the Earth as a system, we knew more about those planets at that time.
NASA takes a long, hard look at this old planet on today's edition of Common Ground. Common Ground is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. There's a new project underway at NASA that will involve dozens of spacecraft, billions of dollars, and mountains of data. It is, in fact, the most ambitious space program currently underway, and the goal is neither the study of far-off phenomenon or the placement of humans on distant planets. This instead is called NASA's mission to planet Earth.
Mission to planet Earth is a mission that NASA has embarked upon to turn its remote sensing technology and space observation capability to looking at the Earth as a system.
This is Dr. Robert Price. He's the director of Mission to Planet Earth. We spoke at the mission headquarters inside NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center.
The Earth itself is a complicated body, much like the human body. It's comprised of many parts that are in different states, and there are a lot of processes that connect those particular parts together. And unless you step back and look at the Earth as a system and understand all those various processes and how they interact, then you're not going to really understand how to look at biodiversity, which is one of the things you've talked about, or you look at deforestation and reforestation. You cannot look at the component parts unless you have a good feel for the big picture.
What kind of things will the mission to planet Earth be able to tell us that we don't already know or can't already find out?
Well, for example, we don't understand the carbon cycle. Carbon is a very important component part of the Earth, and you know, where is it generated, and how does it cycle through the human body, the Earth's body, the oceans, et cetera, the atmosphere? That whole process is not well understood. There appears to be sources and sinks that are missing from our understanding. So that's one place. Just a full understanding of the hydrological cycle is important to us. We have very little data on rainfall over the oceans, for example, and rainfall is not only important because there's obviously a mass change, there's a mass exchange between the atmosphere and the oceans of the land, but there's actually heat released when rainfall occurs, and not being able to measure that whole hydrological cycle is one of the things we have to fill in, a gap in our knowledge that we have to fill in. So there are many places like that, the role of the oceans and the atmosphere where we don't understand exactly what's going on.
Sometimes when we think about this, it's probably easy to think of some things that, like those you've mentioned. Maybe ozone depletion would be something that I could see how satellites and some human technology could measure that. What about loss of species diversity? Is that the kind of thing that we'll be able to find out more about?
Well, you might be able to do that indirectly, I think, is the way we're going to attack that particular problem is that you look at the vegetation dynamics and you look at the various biomes and how those biomes are changing, either because the climate is changing or because humankind is doing something to the land surface or whatever. And then by connecting our scientists, who are remote sensing scientists, who understand the physics and the chemistry and the biology on the larger scale, to biologists who know about given species and what habitat they require, what kinds of conditions they require for food, et cetera, then the connections will be made as to how the grander scale things that we're measuring are impacting biodiversity, the loss of species.
What about migration or other movements of human populations?
Well, again, what will happen is that in response, humankind's adaptation or attempts to adapt to the changes in the climate that might occur because of global warming or ozone depletion or something like that will cause changes in the ability to grow crops or changes in rainfall so that you don't have water resources. And population demographics may have to change. Again, we'll look at the larger scale signs. You can certainly pick out urban areas, but that won't give you a feel for whether the population has moved or is moving.
Yeah. Well, you've given us kind of a taste of the things that that we're going to be that you'll be looking for. Physically, what does the mission to planet Earth entail? What physical objects are being built and will be needed to fulfill this mission?
Well, there will be about 18 total spacecraft. It's five series of different kinds of spacecraft. Some that look at the Earth's atmosphere, some that look at the Earth's oceans, some that look at the land, some that measure aerosols in the atmosphere, others are looking for different kinds of state variables. And there are five series of spacecraft of about three each, and they're to be launched beginning in 1998 all the way up through the year 2013. Then scattered in amongst there are a couple of special missions that are focused on a topic, and they're not repeated though. So it's about 18 or 19 spacecraft between the year 1998 and the year 2013. In EOS alone, now that EOS is the Earth Observing System, and those are the larger spacecraft that are more focused on interdisciplinary problems. We also have a program called Earth Probes, which are smaller spacecraft, more focused instruments. They look at specific state variables, or they look at a single process, and they're to be launched all throughout this time frame too. And they also fall under the Mission to Planet Earth umbrella. So we not only have the larger spacecraft, but we have many smaller spacecraft. In addition, we're building a data and information system. All of this data, all the Earth science data that we're collecting, will go into a data and information system that will be accessible not just by the research scientists that NASA is either sponsoring in a funding sort of a way or involved from other agencies who are sponsoring them, but these data will be available even to high school students, to elementary school teachers, to land resource planners, state and local government decision makers, and of course the federal government policymakers or international folks. So it's a huge data and information system that we're building also. So you'll be able to touch and feel and see spacecraft. You'll be able to touch and feel the data and information system. And the other part of the program, the Mission to Planet Earth program, is, of course, sponsoring the science and funding NASA scientists and university scientists, et cetera, to perform the studies, the research studies that we need.
All right, I want to go back to the data in just a second. But first, you've described this whole mission, and it sounds like a huge undertaking. Is there some way to describe the scope of it in terms of what NASA has done in the past?
NASA has never built a data and information system on this scale. In fact, there's not a comparable data and information system in the civilian world anywhere. There certainly might be such a system in the classified world, but we don't have specific knowledge of that.
In the overall mission to planet Earth, is there anything comparable to that NASA's been done before?
I think not. I think up to this point, we've looked at specific processes, we've looked at specific state variables. We've never looked at the Earth as a system. There's never been a program of scientific research of this scale.
Okay. Well, you mentioned the data, and I think the data is a fascinating sort of subtopic here. There's this huge amount of data that will be generated every day from the equipment that you're talking about. And you mentioned developing systems to deal with that amount of data. Tell us something about that, and then also how it's turned into that useful information that both high school students and university researchers would be interested in.
Okay, well, the Library of Congress is currently estimated to be about 6 to 10 terabytes of data. And in about the year 2000, the Mission to Planet Earth will be accumulating that much data about every 3 days.
Wow.
It's a fantastic amount of data. And a lot of this data has to be turned into images. You just couldn't sort through that much data in a numbers sense. And there's no way to have enough scientists trained or enough scientists even available, even if they were trained, to be able to look at it. So we are developing tools and techniques to turn the data into images and, in fact, turn those images into time sequences, like movie loops or animations, whatever you might want to call them, so that an investigator might be able to, in 30 minutes, watch years worth of data, many years worth of data, and look for the phenomenon that he's trying to study in that. So it's a tremendous amount of data has to be stored and managed and made accessible. And to make it accessible, you've got to describe it, and you've got to catalog it and things like that. And then we will use software tools and techniques to turn it into types of data, like movies, et cetera, that the human mind can grasp much more quickly than sorting through a bunch of numbers.
How much of this is science that's still developing, that by 1998 we hope it'll be there, sort of?
I think a lot of it. This program puts many technologies on the cutting edge. I mean, it drives or pushes technology right to the cutting edge in every case. It's a tremendous amount of data to store, just the physical volume of it. You can't take up warehouses, so you've got to develop new data storage techniques, new media, new devices to keep it available, to catalog it, to index it, to keep track of it. Is a database management problem that's tremendous. And that may be the single most important and most difficult challenge in the whole program, is just cataloging data, characterizing it, describing it, and then having an information management system that scientists or educators or whatever can access and understand. That's probably the biggest single challenge. And then, of course, as I already mentioned, the tools and techniques that go with turning the data into something that we can visually comprehend, something that the human eye and the brain working together can see patterns in or identify phenomena in.
I know it's sort of comparing apples and oranges, but do you know what do you think is more difficult, that end of it, developing what you do with the data and how you store the data, or the collection, building the satellites and the techniques to gather the data?
Well, I hope I wouldn't offend some of my colleagues, but my own bias happens to be in the data system, but I believe that we've had decades of knowing how to build very complex, very well-calibrated instruments. And I think that while there are challenges there, technological challenges, those are a lot easier challenge to face than the database management problem. I think just the sheer volume of the data and the many characteristics that the data has and the many different types of data is a challenge, a problem that no commercial industry has currently faced. Like you might think banks or Social Security has faced this kind of a problem. They haven't. The data are so different and so of so many types that nobody has ever faced this problem. I think that the challenge is in the database management part of the data system.
Okay. One brochure that I read from NASA described the program as, quote, science and technology in support of policy and decision making. Can you explain that role for us?
Yes, I think the real ultimate goal of the mission to planet Earth is not just to develop a sound scientific understanding of the Earth as a system, but in fact we've got to aid in the translation of the scientific results into policy. We've got to develop as a nation and as a world better environmental practices, better resources management policies, and these data and information that we're going to produce from Mission to Planet Earth, the ultimate goal is to turn that information into policy information so that we can make the right decisions about protecting the Earth for future generations.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with Dr. Robert Price. He's the director of NASA's Mission to Planet Earth. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs.
The moniker Mission to Planet Earth is NASA's contribution to the United States program called Global Change Research. And many other federal agencies are participating in it, in this national effort called Global Change Research. But the U.S. effort is part of an even larger effort, an international effort called the International Global Change Research Program. And many scientists around the world Japan, Europe, Canada, et cetera, there, Latin America, there's tremendous participation in this international global change research program. So you go from Mission to Planet Earth, which is NASA's program, is part of the United States effort called the Global Change Research Program, which is part of the international effort called the Global Change Research Program.
Do you know if are any international organizations like the World Health Organization, United Nations Environment Program, other UN agencies involved in that larger?
They all those programs you mentioned are participants in an organizational sense. In fact, the idea for the International Global Change Research Program grew out of the United Nations World Meteorological Organization and the International Council of Scientific Unions. It was a recognition in 1984 by the world-renowned scientists that belonged to those organizations that the Earth was facing some serious consequences in its future, a lot of which were probably human-induced, and it was time that we started taking a look at the Earth as a system. So, in fact, those organizations are very heavily involved in an international effort.
Was there any connection with the Earth Summit in Rio, the UN Conference on Environment and Development?
Well, some of the data that we provided to the Rio Conference was on deforestation using NASA's remote sensing techniques. And we provided to the president and the members of the group that went down there data showing deforestation, of course, in Latin America and indicating similar deforestation types of problems were occurring in our own, the Great Northwest of the United States, and in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, et cetera, where there are exotic woods that are being harvested for commercial purposes. So we did contribute to that conference. It's conferences like that and the conference in Montreal in 1985 or 86 that led to the Montreal Protocol, which controls CFCs. That's the kind of thing that we have to participate in. We have to go from providing our data and information to those kinds of conferences so that, in fact, international, if necessary, decision-making can occur on the environment.
Okay. Back here in the U.S., what's the budgetary and political commitment to this project? I know your budget has been reduced recently, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. When NASA originally estimated its part of the program, the Mission to Planet Earth program, and EOS in particular, it was originally to expend about $17 billion between now, or actually it was like 1992, and the year 2000. And we went through restructuring about 2 years ago because of the budgetary pressures in the United States and reduced the budget from $17 billion to $11 billion. Now, we had to drop some science along the way to do that. We dropped out the science associated with the solid Earth, things like the Earth's crust and the plate tectonics and crustal deformation, et cetera. And we also dropped out some of the tropospheric chemistry parts of the program. And then there was another...
Would you like to explain that for us?
Excuse me?
The last part, the tropospheric chemistry?
We dropped out parts of the program that had to do with the tropospheric chemistry.
Okay, what is that?
That's the chemistry of the most lowest part of the atmosphere, okay. is the troposphere. And we just felt like that wasn't on the scale of things, in terms of the priority importance of the elements that were in the program, that dropping the solid earth parts and dropping the tropospheric chemistry, because we felt like we had a good understanding of tropospheric chemistry, enough to get us by, given the rest of the priorities in the program, that we would drop those parts. Then we went through another, what we called a rescoping just last year or so, where the program dropped from the $11 billion down to $8 billion. So now we're looking at expending between 1992 and the year 2000, approximately $8 billion on the program. It is still, though, probably the single largest scientific program that the United States is engaging in. There is a lot of political support, to follow up on your question. You asked whether there's a lot of backing this. From Vice President Gore, President Clinton, right on down through many members of Congress, including Congressman George Brown and Senator Barbara Mikulski, there's a tremendous amount of support for the country doing a Mission to Planet Earth type of activity. I think that support extends right to John Q. Public. I think everybody out there understands that humankind is doing some uncontrolled experiments on the Earth that may lead to our own dire consequences. So I think we've got support from the people, walking the street that have other jobs, all the way up to the very top of the country's government.
Do you get any of that feeling that some of that support comes from people who might say, well, gee, it seems like we know more about the atmosphere of Venus than we do about the Earth's atmosphere?
Well, that's interesting. In some ways, we do. I mean, the early days of NASA were devoted toward looking outward. It wasn't until the mid to late 70s that we even thought of using our own technology to look back at the Earth. I mean, there were weather satellites, but never to look at the Earth as its state variables or look at some of its processes. We were always looking out. And in fact, we've done more to map Venus and to look at the atmosphere of Mars up until that point and knew a lot about Mercury, et cetera, maybe more than we knew about the Earth as a system. We knew more about those planets at that time. But that's certainly changed. That research approach has certainly changed. I would venture to say now that Mission to Planet Earth is the single highest priority scientific program within the agency and I think within the country right now.
We talked some about some of the academic value of some of the data. Is there a commercial value?
Yes, there is. Commercial use has already been made of remote sensing technology. If you think of the Landsat program, people there have used Landsat data for trying to search for valuable resources, commercial resources like oil or minerals. And it's used in agricultural planning by agribusiness and things like that. We are about to launch a mission this year, we hope in July, called CWIS, which is to look at the ocean's phytoplankton. And that can be a measure of where schools of fish might be located. And I think the same kind of thing continues right on through the Earth Observing System, EOS, where that data can be useful to look at land management. It can be used to look at urban development. It can still be used to look for natural resources. It can be used to look at the oceans for fishery purposes. There are many, many commercial purposes behind remote sensing technology.
I don't know what the commercial relationship is with information from Landsat. Are people paying for that, and will people pay for commercially valuable information from EOS?
Let me answer the second one first. There will be a very nominal charge for EOS data and very nominal charge for any Mission to Planet Earth data. The policy that we're pursuing is that will be the marginal cost of reproduction of the data. So basically you're talking maybe a few hundred dollars. Now the Landsat, or it could be even tens of dollars. I mean, it kind of depends upon how much data you're asking for and what type of data you're asking for. To describe what's happening in Landsat, though, I probably have to trace a little bit of the history of Landsat. Landsats 1, 2, and 3 were done by the federal government. They were done by NASA. And that data was distributed by the U.S. Geological Survey in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It was very reasonably priced. But there was a policy change in the 80s to commercialize remote sensing technology, and Landsat was the test case. And Landsat, as a series of missions, was turned over to a private corporation. And, in fact, they flew Landsats 4 and 5 and were responsible for launching Landsat 6. Now, unfortunately, we lost Landsat 6 to a malfunction. But at any rate, those three were commercial ventures. And the price of Landsat, given that it was a commercial venture, price of Landsat data went up dramatically to several thousand dollars, all the way up to $4,000 or $4,500 a scene. But there, the government wasn't subsidizing it. So those companies had to recoup the cost of the spacecraft and the launch and the ground data operations, et cetera. A public law, though, was passed in 1992, which reverted Landsat back to the federal government. And so Landsats 7 and 8 and any thereafter would come back into the government fold. And, in fact, that specific law, the wording in the law, indicated that users should be charged no more than the marginal cost of reproduction by the government. So you have to go through a little bit of that history to show where we are today. But we hope that high school teachers, elementary school teachers could buy some data for $10 or whatever a scene to use in their science curricula or whatever. But certainly they shouldn't be paying more than a couple hundred dollars for any scene.
Okay, a couple more questions for you. First of all, maybe you probably don't know the answer to this yet, about the launch vehicles you'll be using when it comes that time.
We know that the launch vehicle for the first mission, the first EOS mission, is an intermediate class vehicle. And General Dynamics makes the Atlas vehicle, and that's the vehicle we will use. An Atlas 2AS vehicle will be used for the first mission. we needed to make that decision because we are fast approaching 1998 when the first launch is to occur. The other spacecraft, however, that are coming along in these many series of missions, the launch vehicles have not been decided yet. We have right now, we're in the process of a study as to what vehicles they should be. And once this study is done, we would put a procurement request out on the street and out into the marketplace and ask for bids on it to provide a vehicle that matches our needs in that time domain. And it could be a medium-class launch vehicle or it could be an intermediate-class launch vehicle. We're not sure at this point.
Is it possible it could be part of the space shuttle program or its successor?
No, I think we're looking at launching these on free-flying spacecraft, expendable launch vehicles. We're not looking at launching them on the shuttle.
Okay. Finally, this is really just the last question I have for you. I see a certain symmetry between the success now of the Hubble Space Telescope being able to look out as far into the universe as we've ever been able to, and the mission to planet Earth, looking back at Earth as closely as we've ever looked at it before. Do you see that same sort of connection between those?
Well, the Hubble Space Telescope was certainly a very large-scale mission. It was called the Great Observatory, one of the great observatories for space science. And the recent success there is just tremendous, and it certainly is very uplifting to NASA and I believe the whole nation. We look at EOS as the Great Observatory series for the Earth. I mean, the same kinds of thing. It's to measure all of the variables about the Earth, and so I would say your analogy is kind of close there. We have a series of large missions that are to look at the Earth, just as Hubble was to look outward.
That is Dr. Robert Price, director of the NASA program known as Mission to Planet Earth. I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9409. That's show number 9409, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9409. To order by credit card, you can call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. That's 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. However, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is still 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.